She grew more serious. Okay, whatever. All this means is that we've got to get you back here soon as we can.
Tavalera shook his head. They're not going to let me go, Holly.
Who's not?
The government. The new morality. They're all tangled up together now, and they won't let me leave, I'm pretty certain of that. Holly's square chin went up a notch.
Yeah? Well, we'll just see about that.
Despite himself, Tavalera grinned at her. She's a fighter, he said to himself. But then he thought, it won't do her any good, though. Angelique and Bishop Craig and the rest of them won't let me go. It was something of a shock when he realized that he didn't want to go back to Goddard and Holly. Not yet. Not while he was joined with Stoner. There's too much going on here for me to run away, Tavalera told himself. I've got to stay and help straighten things out. Stoner smiled to himself. Chapter 8 Magnificent desolation, Stoner thought. That's what Buzz Aldrin called it when he first stepped out onto the bleak, airless, battered surface of the moon. It's been nearly a century and a half since Aldrin and Armstrong made the first landing here, Stoner said to himself. The moon's surface hasn't changed much. He stood encased in a sphere of energy that held air and warmth so that he could walk across the moon's dusty surface in his shirt sleeves. Hard radiation poured out of the black star-studded sky, together with an endless infall of microscopic meteors, dust motes drifting in from space. The energy sphere deflected it all. Stoner was pacing across the rounded, smooth crest of the slumped mountains that formed the ring wall of the giant crater Alphonsus. Spread across one segment of the crater floor were landing pads for spacecraft, and broad swaths of dark circles of solar energy farms, where solar voltaic cells manufactured out of lunar silicon drank in the sun's unfailing energy and produced electricity for the human race's largest lunar community. Built into the Ringwall Mountains, Selene was an independent nation, and self-sufficient, almost. Yes, they grow their own food and generate their own electrical power, Stoner thought. With a population approaching 50,000, they probably have a large enough gene pool to survive without bringing up newcomers from Earth. Could Selene and the other lunar communities survive Earth's suicidal war? Would these people want to survive after watching their homeworld go up in nuclear flames? Or would the madmen of Earth throw missiles at the moon and try to complete their self-slaughter? We gave them energy shields, he remembered from his previous life. We learned from the Star Visitor how to make energy shields big enough to protect entire cities from nuclear explosions. But there's no trace of that now. Their cities are open, naked to attack. They have anti-missile systems, but they're crude and certainly not foolproof. Stoner paced carefully along the crest of the ringwall. Down on the crater floor, a spacecraft leaped off one of the concrete launch pads and hurtled into the dark sky, silent in the airless vacuum. In the farther distance, tractors kicked up puffs of dust as they rolled across the barren ground. It's a different world, Stoner knew. Different from the world we left back in 1985. He thought back to the alien starship, the vessel that had changed his life so completely, and his astonishment at finding that it was a sarcophagus, a coffin that bore the dead and lovingly preserved body of an intelligent alien. Stoner understood the message the dead alien symbolized. We exist. You are not alone in the universe. We mean you no harm. Learn from the technology that drives this starship. Come out to the stars and join us. Eventually, Stoner did just that. Saddened, disappointed at the primitive, savage attitudes of his fellow human beings, Stoner took his wife and two children and fled to the stars, leaving Earth far behind them. What they found in their journey changed them profoundly and forced them to return to Earth, burdened with a terrible knowledge. Tapping into his starship's mind, Stoner's vision was flooded with the immensity of space, whirlpools of galaxies spinning in their stately dance of eternity, islands of light and beauty in the empty darkness of infinite space, expanding as far as his mind could encompass. He narrowed his gaze to the Milky Way galaxy, hundreds of billions of stars coalescing out of primordial gas and dust, blazing into light and life, only to gutter and inevitably die. The vision never failed to stir him, to fill him with awe and wonder, and the bitter remorse that stems from the knowledge that death is the inescapable counterpart of life. For even at the core of the immense spiral of the Milky Way, a titanic black hole was gobbling up stars and spewing lethal radiation outward across the galaxy. Closing his physical eyes, Stoner saw the long curving arcs of the geodesics that transected space-time, glowing golden and beckoning against the limitless expanse of the universe. No, not the universe, he reminded himself. It's a multiverse, alive, growing, changing constantly. There are more dimensions than we suspected, he now knew. Space and time are richer and more complex than any human mind understood. He reluctantly admitted to himself that star travel was forever a one-way journey. You literally could not return home. The very act of hurtling among the stars at velocities close to the speed of light changed the universe around you. Somewhere in the entangled geodesics of space-time, there still existed the world that Stoner had departed from, a world where cities were protected by energy shields and human civilization used the alien technology carried by their dead star visitor to shift the nature of matter and energy as they needed. The Earth that he returned to was almost the same, but not quite. The Earth of this world line had never had a star visitor, never received the gift of the dead alien's technology. The differences between the world line that Stoner had left and the one he returned to were slight but significant, possibly fatal. The Earth of this world line was rushing toward doom. There are other Earths, other world lines, Stoner knew. But this was the one he now existed in. This was the one he had to save. Could this civilization last long enough to get through the coming crisis, Stoner wondered. Authoritarian governments armed with nuclear and biological weapons could wipe out the human race, perhaps by accident, perhaps by malice, perhaps by the inspired zeal of true believers. No matter how deep the faith, no matter how repressive the government, greed and hate and lust and fear still existed, palpable forces that could drive men and women to terrible, deadly evils. And there would be no gifts from the stars to help, not in this world line. There's only me, Stoner said to himself. Us, said his wife. We're in this together, Keith. You and me and our children. Chapter 9. Stoner wondered what his best approach would be to make contact with Douglas Stavanger. He had scanned the history webs and learned that not only was Stavanger regarded as the founder of Cellini, he was still crucially important in the Lunar Nation's government, although he had not held any formal post for many years. Standing atop Mount Jaeger, the tallest mountain in the ring wall girdling the crater Alphonsus, Stoner decided on a conventional approach, of sorts. He called Stavanger on the phone. It was a simple matter to tap into Cellini's internal communications net. So while he stood out in the open protected by his bubble of energy, Stoner phoned the man. Stavanger was at home, in his modest living room in the residential area that ran along the fourth level below ground. He was studying a proposal that Cellini's governing council was considering, a proposal to help finance a robotic space probe that would be sent to the Alpha Centauri star system. Good timing, Stoner thought, smiling to himself. I can help them with that, and more. He activated Stavanger's phone. Douglas Stavanger was sitting at his desk admiring the three-dimensional view of the proposed star probe that hovered in midair before his eyes. The hologram was crisp and detailed, showing the probe's wide metallic light sail connected by buckyball cables to the tiny spacecraft, which bristled with sensors and antennas. The proposal had been submitted to Cellini's governing council by the Yamagata Corporation. Yamagata was building a complex of solar power satellites in orbit around Mercury, the closest planet to the Sun, and was offering to devote some of the energy they generated to power a light-sail ship to the Alpha Centauri star system. Cellini would have to build